From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Academy Award-winning actress Patricia Neal. Her public life revolved around her acclaimed stage and screen career. Her private life was more tragic. She writes about both in her new autobiography. Also today, I speak with essayist Harry Stein. Readers of Esquire magazine got a monthly dose of moral dilemmas through his ethics column. Now Stein's attempting to explain the behavior of the American male. His new book's called One of the Guys. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two compact discs featuring the late Igor Stravinsky conducting his own compositions. And we have a lesson in yodeling from Bill Staines. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Actress Patricia Neal suffered a stroke in 1965 at the age of 39. The stroke damaged her memory. She had to relearn the English language and recapture memories of her own life. She had the stroke just a couple of years after she won the Academy Award for Best Actress for her performance opposite Paul Newman in Hud. She played the housekeeper for Newman's family. Newman played an irresponsible womanizer who comes on to Neal. Here's a scene where Newman is driving Neal back to the house with the groceries.
Pick up a beer?
2 6-packs. That ought to see you till tomorrow.
Keeping count on me?
I keep tripping over those empties. I know that. Boy, somebody in this car smells a Chanel number 5. If it isn't me, I can't afford it. Well, you sure weren't riding the range this afternoon, were you?
I sure wasn't.
No. I just wish I knew where some gals get the time during the day. I don't know, by the time I get through scrubbing the kitchen floor, cleaning out the bathtub, hanging up the clothes.
They just drop everything, honey.
I suppose it does beat housework. Want an orange?
Patricia Neal's stroke followed on the heels of two other tragedies. Her baby boy was severely injured when his carriage was struck by a taxi. One of Neal's daughters died of complications from measles. In the years since Neal's stroke, she has regained most of her memory, and now she's collected those memories in a new autobiography titled As I Am. A central part of the book is the relationship she had with Gary Cooper. In 1949, Neal starred opposite Cooper in The Fountainhead. They fell in love and began a long affair, which ended when Cooper's wife and daughter found out. Neal later married writer Roald Dahl, from whom she's now divorced, but it is clear from her book that she will always think of Gary Cooper as the love of her life. I asked Patricia Neal if writing her autobiography was an exercise in remembering.
Oh, yes, it was. And it was, it's fascinating when one starts to write a book on one's life. But, I mean, I did have help. I had help from my mother, newspaper articles, a lot of my friends, and, you know, they would remind me of things. It was a very good thing to do.
How much of your memory has returned since the stroke?
Well, I remember everything that ever happened to me in all my life, except that I do not remember having my stroke, and I am not very good about the hospital. I just remember, a few things about it, and I don't know, maybe a year or two, my memory is not perfect, but I really remember a lot.
You know, you write in your book that the last memory you had before you blacked out when you had your stroke was that you were a mother, you had children, and you could not die. Do you think that being a mother really helped you survive?
I don't really know what helps one survive. I really don't know. I think that some people do and some people don't, and I am not dead sure what makes you. I mean, mine was not. I mean, there was a time when I very much wanted to die. I mean, that lasted more than a day or a week. I very much wanted to for a long time. But now I'm so happy I didn't. Very happy because, I mean, I think life is just staggeringly beautiful now, and I love it.
One of the people who helped you through your recovery from the stroke was Maria Cooper, Gary Cooper's daughter. What's especially interesting about that is that you had had a long affair with Gary Cooper while he was married, and his daughter was very upset when she found out about it. How were you two able to get together again?
Well, Maria had grown up, and I was married, and it had been many, many years. And I think that when I had my horrendous stroke, that's when Maria realized that it would be good of her to write to me, which she did. And I was so grateful. And I wrote with my horrible writing, I wrote back a card saying, thank you, thank you. And I ran into her. I saw her once in New York, and I ran into her in France. And that is when Maria told me about the Abbey of Regina Lourdes. And some months later, I went to the Abbey for the first time, and it's been a beautiful experience for me.
I want to ask you a few things about your relationship with Gary Cooper. You first worked with him on the film The Fountainhead, and you describe in your book this incredible sexual tension between the two of you. Do you think that that was visible on screen? Do you think that that worked in the performance?
Well, I'm told it does, and I think it does. I just took one look at him. he was a great love for me. He was then, and he always will be. You can't really love someone once and just get over them. I cannot. If I loved you once, I will always love you.
Had you been warned about falling in love with leading men or with, you know, fellow actors?
Oh, well, you see, when I was young and I lost my virginity, I guess we say, I was very thrilled, and I thought we would get married, and then I realized it doesn't work that way. And I was a little bitter at the end of that. And then many years later and many affairs I had, well, when I say many, I love people, they say to me, you know, you had so many, but I didn't have all that many. I'm sorry to tell you, I don't know how I got this reputation to being the woman who did it most, more than anybody. I did not do that.
Well, you and Gary Cooper were both very public people. How did you keep your relationship private and out of the press?
Well, we did for some time, but not in the end. The word got around, you know.
Actress Patricia Neal is my guest, and she co-starred with Gary Cooper in The Fountainhead. She won an Academy Award for her role in Hud, and she's just written an autobiography, which is titled As I Am. Now, in discussing how two public people keep a relationship private, you write that Kirk Douglas was frequently your public escort.
Yes, he was a very good man to me.
So he would escort you so that you would have a kind of public beau while not revealing who your real lover was?
But Kirk Douglas, he did not know that in the beginning. He had no idea that I was in love with Gary Cooper. And for a long time I went out with him, and he very kindly took me out, and when he found out about us, he was still very kind to me, and he took me out more even after that. I liked Kirk. He was very good to me once.
You had hoped that Gary Cooper would marry you, but he was married and stayed married. And when his wife and daughter found out, they were obviously very, very upset, and his daughter Maria had spit at your feet when she first met you. You must have
had
really...
No. I had not. That was not first meeting her.
I had met her
on the set and in her house.
But she didn't know then.
No, she didn't. But when she found out about it, of course she spat on the ground. I don't blame her. I would have done so myself.
You see, that's the thing. You must have had such conflicting emotions. On the one hand, loving him so much, really hoping that he would leave his wife. And on the other hand, I bet on some level you really empathized with his wife and understood.
Oh, well, I certainly did. What are you talking about at that point?
At that point.
I was very sorry to do it, but, you know, I loved... Gary very much, and but then when the same thing happened to me,
when your husband left you,
yes,
yeah.
I mean I was just as upset as I'm sure Rocky was in those years, many years before.
Right, Rocky was Cooper's wife.
Yes, Rocky.
So when your husband left you for another woman, years after your stroke, you felt like you understood her reaction to you in a new way?
Well, no, I wouldn't. It's just that it had happened to me, which is kind of a interesting thing that happens to people in their lives, is it not? I mean, I did it to someone else, and in the end, I got it back myself, and it was it's agonizing when it happens to you. It really is. You know, it's it took me a long time to get over it. But I think life is fabulous now. I'm certainly over it, you know.
Patricia Neal is my guest, and the actress is an author of a new autobiography titled As I Am. I want to ask you about your Academy Award-winning role in Hud, which starred Paul Newman. Now, you got that role shortly after your daughter died, and you needed the work, but on the other hand, you needed to be home. How did you work it out so that you were able to work on this film without being far from your family?
Well, Roald, you see, I knew Marty Ridd. I'd known him for years. I knew him in New York, and but when Olivia
this
died...
This is the director, Martin Ridd, you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, yeah. Yes. I'm so sorry I didn't tell you. But I know that I... We had to do something to make a little money. You know, we weren't all that rich. And so I did a little small television film, I think, in Hollywood. And Marty Ridd, he sent me HUD. And, well, I loved it. I loved it. But I couldn't have been away from home all that long a time because, I mean, it was very disturbed by my Olivia's death. And... But I know that I went home, and I discussed it with Roald, and he thought that I should do it if I could come home in the middle of it, which is what I very much wanted to do, too. And Marty said, well, he told me that in Hollywood, that he would shoot me, and then I would have about 3 or 4 weeks off, and I could go home again, and then I could meet them in Hollywood and finish the film. And I was delighted that he did that. And, oh, he was such a good man and a very good director. And I was very grateful to him for doing that.
When he first sent you the script, when the director, Martin Ritt, first sent you the script, he expressed his fears that you would think the part was too small. Were you worried about that? And what made you realize that this was going to be a good part? I'm sure you didn't realize you'd win an Academy Award for it, but you saw something in this part.
Well, I hadn't done a film for a long time. And, no, I liked the character. I thought it was very, very good. I did not think I would win the award for it, but I was happy I did.
Describe the character.
Describe her? Oh, how do I describe her? She was a woman who had had her go. I mean, she had a lot of tough things that happened to her, and she could, she could take it.
And you identified with that?
Oh, yeah.
There was a scene that you shot with Paul Newman in which he's coming on to you, and you were distracted by something that wasn't in the script, a fly on the screen door. Would you describe that? Would you describe what happened?
Oh, that was great. I was, we were on the porch, and he's making a pass at me.
And you're doing what, washing the dishes?
No, I'm doing something with the cheese, I think, and sort of squeezing it out. And this horsefly kept coming up to the screen. And I said my line, and I killed the horsefly. And that worked beautifully. And, you know, it was a very good thing.
So you figured that this might be edited out because this horsefly and you swatting it was not supposed to be
part
of the scene.
No, I thought it'd be a good thing. And it was, and Marty loved it.
My guest is Patricia Neal, and she won an Academy Award for her role in Hud. She's written a new autobiography titled As I Am, and it's about her life, her acting career, and also the stroke that she suffered from in 1965 and her long recovery from it and her return to acting. I want to talk with you more about your life and your acting, but first we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Actress Patricia Neal is my guest, author of the new autobiography, As I Am. I'd like to ask you about when you first came to New York and you started breaking into acting. You were a young girl from Tennessee, not used to New York by any means. And you write in your book that in New York you made the rounds, smile by smile, flirt by flirt. Did flirting help?
Oh, yes, of course. And I was from the South, you see, and women in the South, we flirt. We're brought up that way. I'd had 2 years at Northwestern University outside of Chicago. And then I came to New York, and I tell you, I really worked hard. I mean, I would wake up at the crack of dawn, and I would be the first person in offices when they would get going, and I would make the rounds all morning, and then I would go and work in the Greenwich Village Cafe during the lunch hour, and then I would. And in the afternoon, I would make rounds again.
If you're flirting while you're making those rounds, how do you let people know that this is just flirting and you're not going to do the whole casting couch routine?
Oh, I didn't think that way. No,
you're too naive to think that way, right?
Yeah, I was naive. I was very naive when I first came to New York.
What was your first big break?
Understudying Voice of the Turtle. I think I'd been here only 2 months when I read for that, and dear Deliagra, Alfred Deliagra, he just wanted to give me the job. I know that his wife to be that she didn't think I was right, nor did the playwright think I was right, but he said, "Well, I'm going to give it to her," and he did. And he was so beautiful to me; he really was.
I want to ask you about how you broke back into acting after your stroke. You did suffer some memory loss. Did you ever feel like you forgot how to act?
No, but I didn't want to go back to it. I really didn't want to go back. But my ex-husband, Roald Dahl, he shoved me into it. And I'm delighted that he did so now. I really am, even though I remember when I first came to do this this film. Oh, I was furious that I was going to have to do it, and I didn't want to at all. And then we started rehearsals. We rehearsed for about a week. And, the first day I hated it, and the second day, and the third day I began to sort of like it. Well, at the end of that film, I was the most delighted woman in the world. I mean, that's what I needed to begin to live again. And it really... It brought me back to life.
What film was it?
It was The Subject Was Roses.
And why were you so furious at your husband for pushing you back into acting?
Well, I didn't want to act. And, I thought it was very... what's the word I'm looking for? But I thought it was wrong of him to shove me back into it when I didn't particularly want to. You know, I had been doing nothing for such a long time that just the idea of... But I think it was fright, really. I think I was so frightened at the idea of acting again or trying to act again. And but when I realized, you see, when I began to do it, and I began to love it, then that was the joy.
What kind of roles were you offered? You were several years older than you'd been before in your last movie, and the directors who were offering you roles also knew about the stroke that you had suffered, and I'm not sure if that affected the way they saw you as an actress.
No, I don't think it did. Actually, I played a lot of people who were dying, ill people who were dying. I've played about three or four of those parts. I love them, though. They're very good. And I played the mother of a son who was dying of leukemia. And
what's good about a dying role?
Oh, you can certainly get your hand in. I like it, really.
Now, you've also starred in several commercials. You did the Maxim Coffee commercials.
Yes.
And Anison commercials.
And Anison.
Did that work out well for you? It was a fairly easy role to do, and they probably pay really well to do those commercials.
Oh, well, Anison, they paid well. I mean, I think Maxim was the first one I did, and I don't think... I'm not sure. I don't think they paid a lot in those days, and or else my husband didn't know enough to ask for a lot. I don't know, but but I love doing it. They're fun to do. They really are.
It's interesting to me in the Maxim commercial. You play the role. You played the role of a housewife, really. But through your life, you were pretty much of a free thinker sexually, and I think that your real life in many ways wasn't exactly the role in that commercial. But
you know, I tell you, I love this reputation I'm getting now.
Well, you wrote about
it. I made a mistake. I mean, because I've been totally loyal for 35 years, so and that was years and years ago.
When you were recovering from your stroke, and after you had the memory loss, and you were trying to remember the things that you had forgotten, did you want to remember everything, or was there a temptation to just keep it forgotten?
No. I don't have a... I never lie, or I never... it's very strange, but I do not have the tendency to tell lies or you know. I mean, as to me, the truth is the truth, and I say it all the time.
No, I realize that, and your book does seem to be very honestly written. But in your book, you thank the nuns at the Abbey for giving you the strength to remember and to want to remember, and it made me think that there was probably a lot that you had forgotten that you almost weren't interested in remembering, that you'd just as soon have forgotten about, and that it was painful to relive and to remember certain experiences.
Well, it is, but, you know, it's just that I really had to remember it and to write this book, and I had to remember it to go from one day to the next, to the next, to the next.
You had almost forgotten the language after your stroke.
Oh, yes. I don't think I think I had to sing. I didn't say a word, and I know that Jean Alexander, who was my nurse in the hospital, she was singing one day when she was giving me a bath, and I began to sing with her, and she was delighted. And you know, it seems that words of songs, they come back before anything else does. It's very strange. But I could not talk, for a long time. I would mix words up and that sort of thing.
You had a woman who worked with you on language and on your memory and on helping you out. What were some of the things that she did to help you regain your speech and regain your memory?
Well, I found it difficult to read. I didn't even know one word from the other when I first became conscious. My son, he used to give me reading lessons. You know, he would say cat and dog. I mean, they'd be written. And because he had had to have those cards when he was young. And I didn't even know what that meant. I knew what nothing meant. You have no idea how, when your brain is operated on, I mean, you have no brain. It's sad.
Your book opens with a quote from Helen Keller. You played Helen Keller's mother in the Broadway production of The Miracle Worker?
Yes.
Did her story become more significant to you later in life?
Oh, yes. I mean, Helen Keller, she means so much to me now. It's astonishing that I played her mother once, isn't it? And I quote from her quite often. And she was a fabulous... I never met her. I'm sorry I didn't. I know that Anne Bancroft and Patty Duke, they met her just before they started the film. But I never met her, and I would like to have, because I quote her from always, you know, in my speeches. She's a great woman. And in my book starts with her writing.
Is there a quote from her that means the most to you?
Oh, well, have you ever been to sea in a dense fog, when it seemed as if a tangible white darkness shut you in, and the great ship, tense and anxious, groped away toward the shore with plummet and sounding line, and you waited for something to happen. Well, that's the beginning of one.
Is that how you once felt?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's fantastic that I did play her mother on the stage, and all of a sudden, I was Helen Keller, you know, after many years.
Do you want to act anymore?
Oh, yes, I love to act. I adore acting. I think, to me, it's the greatest joy in the world is to act beautifully.
But you said you haven't been acting much lately.
No, because I've been writing a book, and you know, when you have not worked for a long time, people forget you. They really do. You know, they do not think of employing you, but I would love to begin. Love somebody to offer me a job.
Are you hoping that this book will help people remember that you're interested?
Oh, I hope it will. I really, you know, I would like to act again.
Well, I'd like to see you acting again. Thank you very much for talking with us.
I thank you.
Patricia Neal's autobiography, As I Am, is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with writer George Whitmore. His new book, Someone Was Here, tells the stories of people whose lives have been altered by AIDS. While he was working on the book, Whitmore discovered that he, too, has the disease. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, writer Harry Stein offers himself as an example of the modern American male. His new book, One of the Guys, is an autobiographical analysis of entering puberty with Playboy magazine, then coming of age in an era of feminism. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Stravinsky Conducts Stravinsky, featuring performances of some of Stravinsky's best-known compositions. And folk singer Bill Staines teaches us how to yodel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. The whereabouts of the Islamic hijackers who commandeered a Kuwaiti jumbo jet to Algiers are unknown at this hour. They were allowed to escape in exchange for the freedom of their 31 remaining hostages, who were released today. Barnaby Mason has details.
Kuwait insists that it made no concessions to the hijackers' demand for the release of 17 Islamic militants from prison. And from the Algerians' point of view, putting the hijackers on trial would be quite impossible. It would destroy their reputation for neutral mediation, which has certainly been enhanced by this affair. The hostages are said to be in good health, considering their dreadful ordeal, but the psychological effects may be long-lasting. For the Egyptian head of the cabin crew, it was the second time he'd been involved in a hijacking. He described the terror he felt on seeing the cold, expressionless eyes of one of the hijackers, like a shark, he said. Other passengers said they'd spent the whole time with plastic straps on their wrists. One old man was struck when he demanded to go to the lavatory. Another had a pistol put to his head and two blanks fired in a mock execution.
The BBC's Barnaby Mason in Algiers. Secretary of State George Shultz today condemned the hijackers as murderers. He said that letting them go violates international standards. But he said he would not criticize the Algerian government because he does not have details of the agreement worked out between the gunmen and Algerian negotiators. The Pentagon has ended its search for the Cobra helicopter, which disappeared during Monday's fighting in the Persian Gulf. The pilot and co-pilot have been formally declared missing. Officials say there is no reason to believe the helicopter was shot down, despite Iranian claims. The Pentagon says it still does not know what happened. As the situation appears to be calming down in the Gulf, U.S. officials are carrying out a review of the latest incidents. NPR's Anne Garrels reports.
According to White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, the U.S. policy of protecting the vital sea lanes will not change. What may change are the Navy's rules of engagement. A senior White House official said the U.S. may take an even broader role in the Gulf, but only if there's more and systematic cooperation from the allies. The United States will discuss this next week at a NATO planning meeting. While the Gulf was relatively quiet today, U.S. officials are concerned Iran will step up its terrorist attacks. Officials say Iran has clearly become more desperate in its war with Iraq and more aggressive in its attacks on others. In addition to mining the Gulf, the U.S. believes Iran supported, perhaps directed, the hijacking of the Kuwaiti plane. And officials revealed that Iran recently tried to bomb a Saudi oil refinery. I'm Anne Garrels in Washington.
The funeral of PLO Deputy Chief Khalil al-Wazir, or Abu Jihad, was missing a prominent mourner today. The PLO chairman, Yasser Arafat, did not attend. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians attended the funeral of Abu Jihad. A coffin draped with a Palestinian flag was hand-carried through the Yarmouk refugee camp on the outskirts of the Syrian capital. Earlier today, Yasser Arafat was expected to deliver a speech at the cemetery, but he remained in Libya. His absence shows there's been a snag in what was expected to be a rapprochement between Syria and the PLO. Arafat has not been welcome in Damascus since 1983, when he was expelled from the country. However, Syrian officials welcomed the PLO here for the funeral of Abu Jihad. The PLO leader accepted, however, he included some conditions: a summit with the Syrian president and a welcome at the airport equivalent to a head of state. Negotiations continue tonight. At today's funeral, the flags of Palestinian nationalism were raised in the Syrian capital, but without the movement's most important symbol, the PLO leader. In Damascus, this is Deborah Amos.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 14 points, closing at 1985.41. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The CBS Masterworks label has just released two compact discs of Igor Stravinsky conducting his own music. One includes his two most popular ballet scores, Petrushka and The Rite of Spring. The other has three of his symphonic scores. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says that despite Stravinsky's claims, very little of his music was ever completely abstract.
Stravinsky said he didn't believe in interpretation. If musicians simply followed his scores, the pieces should come out right. But from fairly early in his career, Stravinsky began to record his own music so people could hear exactly what he intended. Some of his earliest 78s are fascinatingly awkward. Musicians weren't as familiar with his music, partly because there were few other recordings. And in those days, Stravinsky himself wasn't such a good conductor. Unlike another 20th century composer-conductor, Benjamin Britten, Stravinsky never made a commercial studio recording of anyone else's music. But like Britten, Stravinsky became his own best conductor. No one has ever surpassed the spaciousness, the flow and color of his performances, the electricity of his phrasing. Not every attack may be razor sharp, but Stravinsky's rhythmic bite is such a source of joy and juice. On CD, you can hear more details than ever, and there's the luxury of uninterrupted continuity in the complete ballets. The magic casements of these recordings seem to open directly onto the distant worlds of these extraordinary scores. This Rite of Spring shows not only the violent energy, but also the deep solemnity and beauty of pagan Russian ritual. Petrushka places the pathos of the lonely artist, the puppet Petrushka, in the context of the breathtaking kaleidoscopic bustle of a turn-of-the-century Shrovetide fair. On the other Stravinsky CD are three later works, cleverly packaged together because each has the word symphony in the title. The least well-known is his major key, Neoclassical Symphony in C, composed during what he called the unhappiest period of his life, the diagnosis of his own tuberculosis, and soon afterwards the deaths of his wife and his older daughter Mika from the same disease, and the death of his mother. Stravinsky wrote, characteristically, quote, "I was able to continue my own life only by my work on the Symphony in C, but I did not seek to overcome my grief by portraying or giving expression to it in music. And you'll listen in vain, I think, for traces of this sort of personal emotion." There is something obsessive about the Symphony in C, but it's also an exhilarating, exuberant work. One passage Stravinsky wrote, quote, would not have occurred to me before I had known the neon glitter of the California boulevards from a speeding automobile. The other two symphonies on this CD show two other important sides of Stravinsky, the religious and the political. The Choral Symphony of Psalms, composed in 1930, is one of his major devotional works. The powerful symphony in three movements, written during World War II, was inspired by newsreels of goose-stepping soldiers and Chinese scorched earth tactics. The haunting slow movement, however, with its delicate passages for harp, was actually first intended as music for a vision of the Virgin Mary in the movie The Song of Bernadette.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Stravinsky Conducts Stravinsky, two compact discs on the CBS Masterworks label. This is Fresh Air. Harry Stein thinks that his life offers some pretty typical examples of the dilemmas faced by his generation of men. His boyhood fantasies were shaped by Playboy centerfolds. He came of age during the sexual revolution and feminism. He became a father in his early 30s and was terrified that it would be all downhill from there. But he's ended up enjoying fatherhood so much that he now writes a syndicated humor column about family life. Harry Stein used to wrestle with moral questions in his monthly ethics column in Esquire magazine. His new autobiography, One of the Guys, is an attempt to explain the condition of men today. But he says that in telling his story, he wanted to stay away from the spiritless, self-serious writing that constitutes the new male confessional tone.
I, and I think men in general, go to almost any lengths to avoid seeming overly sincere and earnest. God forbid we not allow ourselves the escape hatch of kidding around, of being able to say we were only joking.
Well, the impression I get is that you wanted to write this book about being a man without having to join the new male club.
Yeah. Somebody asked me, what are you so embarrassed about being a new man? I mean, that term has such onerous associations for me.
Why? I mean, I think I understand, but why?
Because it seems like the assumption is that one has given up who one was and has kind of joined a core of new men. I don't think I've changed fundamentally who I am. I think it's been a growth process.
And you don't feel that a man needs to be overly pious and sensitive to discuss what it means to be a man today?
No, I think that's it's completely bogus. I mean, when people do that, they're putting on an act to a certain extent for women.
You spent some time in Paris when you were young, writing for a French weekly.
It was actually English language, yeah.
An English language weekly, right? Published in Paris.
It was great.
And while you were there, you met a woman who you were lovers with for a while, and you barely spoke each other's languages. Apparently, you didn't have much in common, but you had a good relationship while it lasted. I'm sure a lot of it was sexual. Was that an important part for you to have a kind of sexual relationship with someone where you weren't similar at all? You know, I think a lot of people really need to go through a period like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure why, but I'm sure that it's true.
I think the main thing about her was that she was French. I mean, I just love the idea of having this this relationship with this French woman. I mean, it was. I write about that Paris period as being the Playboy fantasy realized, as for myself and for a lot of other people I knew. There were men. I was going to say men and women both, but it was only men.
Are you glad you went through living to some degree your fantasy so that you could never like wake up in the middle of the night and say, "Oh my God, now I'm married with two children and I've never had a chance to
Absolutely.
Experience what that would have been like"?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are so many people living with profound regrets about that. I suppose more men than women, men who lived through the sexual revolution, but never felt they got their share. I mean, there are a lot of regrets of those kinds. I've been accused by certain people, notably one of my brothers, actually, of bragging in the book about my sex life during that period. And I suppose there is an element of that. I mean, I look back on it with a kind of wonderment that I and we could have lived through such an era. On the other hand, it was also a terribly lonely period. And whenever I think of what a fantastic time we were alleged to have had, I also think of the lack of emotional content.
You are now married. You have two children.
Yes.
And I remember the ethics column that you wrote in Esquire called "To Breed or Not to Breed." That was the headline of this particular column.
Yes.
And it was about having gone through an abortion and then your lover, who became your wife, getting pregnant again and you deciding to have the baby. And you ended the column by saying that, you know, with the baby on the way, you found yourself by turns elated, morose, and scared to death.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the things that you worried about when you were a father-to-be, which ones actually came true and which ones didn't when you were a father?
Well, I think there was the sense that life as one had always known it was coming to an end. And one saw that as a distinctly negative thing. I, in any case, have always felt a certain ambivalence and regret about having had to give up the energy I'd once devoted to my career. But on the other hand, the trade-off has been so overwhelmingly positive on balance that that it seems a small thing to carp about. I think, like most men, I failed to appreciate how children can bring one to life. How, as I quoted one man in the book saying, circuits that had been dead for 30 years suddenly kicked in. A lot of women have complained about men making such a big deal about fatherhood.
About expecting a standing ovation for the kinds of things that women have done throughout history.
Yeah, as one woman said to me, you know, you act like no one's ever been a father before. I think they're absolutely right. I mean, I certainly see that point. But what they fail to appreciate is the extent to which that role has forced us to make emotional connections that we never even believed possible.
Should I tell you the one thing that I think women distrust about some men who spend so much time writing about their children? And I don't think I'd put you in this category, really.
Yes.
So this isn't meant to be an insult, but I'd just like to get your thoughts on it. That there's this image of the man who is ostensibly home with the kids and taking care of them, but is really in like the study anguishing over which word to use to describe how much he loves his kids, while his wife is actually there diapering them and preparing the bottle.
Well, actually, strangely enough, my daughter accused me of, not really accused me, but made a remark about that. We were having a conversation a couple of weeks ago. She said, "Papa, is this a real conversation or is this for the column?" I mean, you're right. There's an element of that. I think it's a fair accusation. I can't tell you how fortunate I feel for the relationship I have with my kids. It's incredibly sustaining and amusing and fun. I mean, it isn't just, you know, all those kinds of pious new man-ish words. It's fun.
I want to ask you an ethics question, since you used to write the ethics column. You reveal a lot about your father, about his flaws as a man and as a father. And, I mean, it's your dad, and now, you know, he's got a reputation of his own, and you're exposing all these personal things that he's probably never written about himself. Did you really think hard about that before deciding to commit all of that to print?
Yeah, it was the hardest part of doing this book. And, in fact, I showed my father an earlier version of the book, and there were things that hurt him a great deal. And I changed them. I let him know that the purpose of this was not to hurt him in any way. I didn't want to do that.
know what you were just saying about how much fun it is being a father?
Mm.
One thing I've observed, and I don't know why this is or what it means, or maybe it's not an accurate observation, but it seems to me that a lot of fathers perceive parenting as kind of fun, and whereas for a lot of women it's there's a lot of more like hard work involved with it and chores and things like that in addition to the fun.
Well, I think there's always been that breakdown. It's a classic breakdown. I just did a column about that, in fact, where which was entitled Three Babies and a Woman. And, you know, we're the ones. One woman told me with some irritation that she's actually come into rooms and heard her husband and two children sing, "This is the room where we drop our crumbs, drop our crumbs, drop our crumbs. This is the room where we drop our crumbs when mommy isn't watching," you know, things like that. Fathers have I think, tended traditionally to be the games players and the kidding arounders. And the mothers have been the voice of authority, not really authority, but, you know, the killjoys. And I don't think that's changed during this era.
Well, then things really aren't equal yet, are they?
Things might be equal. They're not the same. I mean, people aren't the same. Men and women are not the same. I mean, my wife says, quite frankly, you know, she doesn't enjoy getting down on the floor and crawling around and flipping people around the way I do. But she enjoys reading and cuddling every bit as much as I do, if not more.
I guess what I mean is, are you having all the fun at the expense of doing some of the work?
I avoid all the work I can. I mean, I'm very bad about that. I mean, I was I said in the book that I did 40% of the housework, and I was called on that in an interview yesterday. It was true the day I wrote that in the book. I try to contribute and I try to change, but that's a real struggle for me. It really is. And
well, what's so hard?
As it is for my wife. Neither of us, we're both slobs. I mean, she's as rotten at it as I am. So we end up, what is hard about it? It's not fun is what's hard about it. It's not something we want to do.
Harry Stein is the author of One of the Guys, The Wising Up of an American Man. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up from National Public Radio with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
We're following up on the New York primary victory by Governor Michael Dukakis, the Democratic primary. Linda Wertheimer analyzes the rather high degree of negative voting in that primary, people who cast their votes either for Dukakis or for Gore or Jackson in order to not vote for another candidate, they said, according to the exit polls. Also, we have reports on the burial of PLO leader Abu Jihad in Syria and the end of the hijacking in Algiers and a Supreme Court decision upholding a decision by the Veterans Administration to deny benefits to two men who were alcoholics.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Classic country music records have made many of us wish we knew how to yodel. Folk singer Bill Staines joins us with a lesson in how to do it.
Somewhere around 20 years ago, I used to hang out at a place called The Maples in Billerica, Massachusetts. It was kind of a country and western roadhouse, and there was a fellow there by the name of Johnny White who used to do some yodeling, and I got to know Johnny pretty well and found out exactly what yodeling was all about. I bought his 45 RPM record, slowed it down to 16 RPM, and I could pick out the yodeling syllables. Basically what it is it's just a controlled crack in your voice in intervals of sixths. Six being the notes, something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or every once in a while a seventh will appear, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And after you get the controlled crack in your voice down, which is really the hard thing because you have to crack your voice up and then crack your voice back down, hello, then all that's left is just learning the syllables to the song and when to crack your voice. And so after a while, I got so I could do a little bit of yodeling, and this is a song that I wrote, and it's called The Happy Yodel. I'm walking along, just singing a song. It's been so long that I've been away. I've walked down the highways, thumbed down the byways, and now I am home here to stay. There's a girl in the valley, and her name
name is Sally, I hope she's still waiting for me. Well, I missed her so much and I long for her touch, and it's her that I'm longing to see. And I sing her a yodel, a happy yodel, and we will be married in spring. And the birds will be singing and the bells will be ringing, and she'll be wearing my ring. There's a girl in the valley and her name is Sally, I hope she's still waiting for me. Well, I missed her so much and I long for her touch, and it's her that I'm longing to see. And I sing her a yodel, a happy yodel, and we will be married in spring. And the birds will be singing and the bells will be ringing, and she'll be wearing my ring.
People have asked me over the years about the origin of yodeling, and I did an extensive research project into it one time and found that it was a result of a lot of climbing accidents. That's in the Alps. That's where I think it came from. But really, it was a communication form that, as communications improved, became more of an art form. And so there are yodels from all over the world, and you should try it sometime.
Bill Staines is based in southern New Hampshire. His album Wild Wild Heart is on the Philo label. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with comic Sandra Bernhardt, best known for her appearances on Late Night with David Letterman and her role in The King of Comedy. She's now starring in an off-Broadway one-woman show that satirizes the women of rock and roll. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review I'm Your Man, the new album from Leonard Cohen. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review The Manchurian Candidate, starring Frank Sinatra, Lawrence Harvey, and Angela Lansbury. This 1962 film has just been re-released. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.